there is Srila Bhakti Chintani, but I think there's a patron's council meeting, and that's why everyone is over there. I don't really know what we're supposed to talk about, particularly in terms of the book, but let me find one verse. This is small print. And which is really the key point or the central point of this book. The main purpose of writing Srila Bhakti Chintamani was because I was always getting perennial questions about or from many devotees asking whether they should be reading these books or those books, some other books, and what books are bona fide, what books aren't bona fide, what the qualified, what are devotees' qualifications for reading or not. And it's a very relevant issue. And for that reason, this book sort of really ended up becoming, although it was the fourth book in the series, it ended up becoming the introduction to the other books, since it addresses just that issue of who is qualified to read what, which is just a more specific focus on who is qualified to practice what kind of Krishna consciousness, or what level of Krishna consciousness. And not only qualified, but actually what are devotees' responsibility for that? And because there are two ends of the spectrum, one is that someone does something that's beyond their qualification, and the other one is that one neglects what they're qualified for. Each other equally erroneous, and the consequences of each can be the same, which is vinashati, is that one's spiritual life becomes hampered. Srila Goswami says, Atyahara prayasasya prajapo niyamagraha jana sangha saloyam ca sadbir bhaktir vinashati. So, vinas. One's spiritual life is cut, is severed, is destroyed, and here particularly one of the six symptoms is niyamagraha. And that's what this verse relates to in his Bhaktya Lokya book, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There he's gives commentary on some of the verses of Upadeshamrita, very detailed commentaries, very interesting. And on this Niyamagraha or Niyamagraha, then he quotes Krishna's instruction to Uddhava. It's the verse that I'll quote, and as I saw, it's quoted three times in the book, although it's referred to more often. And Niyamagraha, Niyamagraha, they are the two aspects of the same thing. One is that one does something that one is not qualified for, and the other one is one neglects something that one's qualified for. I think the first one we know we have a general terminology for that. It's called sahajiya. Sahajiya means one takes something too cheap. That means that, I don't know, you go into a jeweler's and you want to buy a diamond necklace for £20. In other words, you haven't got what it takes. You haven't got the price of the commodity. So you're taking it cheaply. You think diamonds are worth £20, are you crazy? What are you doing in here? They just throw you out. It's an insult even to offer to because you're undervaluing something. You don't know the value of something. So when you don't have the appropriate currency for something, or you don't have, in this case, the appropriate devotion, but you want to practice a certain kind of devotional service, that's called taking it cheaply. And I think everyone's familiar with this type of terminology. We use it a lot, sometimes unnecessarily, but just recently one devotee wrote me a letter. She's a pujari. She said, I'm worshipping deity and I'm feeling that I'm getting attached to the deity. Am I becoming a sahaja? And I thought, boy, if our movement's coming to this, that you finally become Krishna conscious and you start thinking, am I becoming a sahaja? And really misunderstanding things. So no, becoming attached to Krishna isn't sahaja. But if you try to do it artificially, if you try to force attachment, can come in all stages of Krishna consciousness. But if you try to force something, force some symptoms of attachment, or expect a certain level of attachment that is way beyond the current level of devotional service, then that's taking it cheaply. And then the other side is that you're 25 years old and you're still in nursery. You can't sit around in a nursery when you're 25 years old. First of all, they'll think you're a pedophile. Second of all, you know, it's just, you're too big. You gotta get out of here. This is even a more common issue. The devotees say, oh, I'm not so advanced, but I'm not. That's not for me. But it is for you. And it is one's duty to progress as they're meant to progress. And if by the proper execution of devotional service, they should take on suitable responsibility or services that come as a natural consequence of their devotional service. Anyway, let me quote this verse. So this is what this book is about. And it's a phenomena that we practice all the time. We practice it in our Krishna consciousness. We practice it outside. You practice it when you go to school. It's the common basis of education. If you're an employer or an employee, you practice it. When you have an employee, according to the qualification, you engage them. If you see someone who's capable of being a supervisor of 100 people, then you don't make them a sweeper. Otherwise, you're a bad employer. On the other hand, if someone, all they can do is sweep, and you make them a supervisor, then you're also a bad employer. So you have to be able to judge, evaluate people's abilities, and engage them accordingly. Similarly, Rupa Goswami gives us so many symptoms by which one should be able to assess one's own qualities. And that's not being proud, that's not being unrealistic, but that's what you do in life. You always have to assess where you're at in order to know where you're going. If you don't know where you're at, how do you know where you're going? You can only set a direction if you know where you are. And if you don't know where you are, or you have some kind of fixation about thinking that humility means being in ignorance of where you are, then it's really hard to figure out where you're going to go and how you're going to get there. So charting a path means from where you are to where you want to go. And then the systematic steps that it requires to get there. Root here. Krishna speaking to Uddhava. This is in the 21st chapter of the 11th canto. This 11th canto is a very, very wonderful part of Srimad Bhagavatam. And particularly, because there's already a book out on Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur's or Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary.
Vishwanath Chakravarti.
Yeah. And it's like Bhagavad Gita, not as famous as Bhagavad Gita, but more detailed. Certainly when it comes to devotional service, Krishna really goes into much more detail. He reveals more to Uddhava. Circumstances were a little more relaxed than on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and also more confidential. Krishna had no problem speaking devotional service to Arjuna, but Arjuna wasn't the only person around. There were a lot of other people there who really didn't have so much qualification to hear about these things. Now here, and here's the point, Bhaktivinoda Thakur refers to this verse, and he uses it to elaborate on this principle, niyama agraha. Se se dikari yanishta saguna prakriti yatita viparyayas tudoshasya ughayo esha nischaya. Steadiness in one's own position is declared to be actual piety, whereas deviation from one's position is considered impiety. In this way, the two are definitely ascertained. This is a little sutric. In other words, the real meaning is sort of unbundled, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains. But svesi adhikara je nishta. The principle is that everyone has a qualification, adhikar, for something. Sve sve adhikara ye nishta. And when you're qualified to do something, the symptom of that is that you're steady. When you don't achieve steadiness in a particular activity, it means you're lacking qualification for it. So here, just to exemplify what it is that we're talking about, there's a flight of stairs. The qualification for stepping onto the fifth stair is that you're standing on the fourth. If you're steady on the fourth stair, then you have the qualification for stepping up onto the fifth. And let's not talk about jumping stairs and so on, which is not a stable way of going. If you're on the second step, walking, going up to the fifth, that's called sahaja. You don't have the qualification. You need to be closer. It's too much of an unstable move. It's too large a step to make. So you need to be steady on the fourth step. On the other hand, if you're on the fourth step and you think that, you know, going up to the fifth step is, you're going to get, I don't know, it's not called seasickness, what's it called when you're afraid of heights? Or, vertigo. Or you're going to fall off, or, I don't know, the roof's going to cave in. Then that's just paranoia. You know, four and five, there's not that much difference. If you can stand on the fourth, you can stand on the fifth. And you certainly have the qualification for it if you're standing steadily there. So here Krishna says, sadhana parikirtita. Everyone should know what standard of activity are they qualified at now. The other example is that of school. A child is going to grade 3. If he does well in grade 3, well, what does that mean? Then naturally he's qualified to enter into the fourth grade. If he does well, and he doesn't do well, if he's actually failing his grades, what does that mean? That means that he's not qualified to go into fourth grade. That means first he needs to be qualified where he is, and that then becomes the basis for making the next step. And this is how Krishna also uses this terminology, shanai shanar uparama, is that step by step, we should go forward in spiritual life. So in regards to, particularly, what should I hear? Srimad Bhagavatam glorifies two things particularly. Shinvata Sakta Krishna, hearing about Krishna. And the other thing is the 14th verse of the first canto, how does it start? Taddeveti Svayam Bayam Apana Samshito Ginam. It talks about chanting the holy name of the Lord, which is feared by fear to sanctify. Apana Samshito Ginam. Taddeveti Svayam Bayam. So chanting and hearing, those are the two things. Apana Samshito Ginam, 368. Living beings who are entangled in the complicated measures of birth and death can be freed immediately by even unconsciously chanting the holy name of Krishna, which is feared by fear personified. So two things, chanting and hearing. This is the essence of Bhagavad Dharma. This is what Srimad Bhagavatam is teaching. And there are different subject matter for hearing, and there's different types of chanting. So, what should one hear? What is one qualified to hear? When are we qualified to read Krishna book? When are we qualified to read Chaitanya Charitamrita? When are we qualified to hear about Krishna dancing with the gopis? When are we qualified to read some other Goswami literature? It's not all the same. It's different. There is a different prescription for each particular category of hearing. And one should know what one's qualification is for hearing what. We start with here, Suisi Adhikara Jiri Nishta. We start by our qualification for trying to understand that we're not this body. We hear Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is teaching that is both compulsory and necessary for everyone. And everyone should hear the topics and subject matter of the Gita. And one should have a understanding of difference between body and soul. Krishna's Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth, is a person. He's not impersonal. That we are Mamai Vangsa Jiva Loka, Jiva Bhuta, Sanatana, we're Krishna's eternal servants, and Sarvadharma Paritya. And our business is surrendered to Him. So we should understand the topics of Bhagavad Gita. And because in Bhagavad Gita, what does Krishna says, Mamana Bhava Mad Bhakto, then we should study the science of devotional service, once we've understood what Bhagavad Gita is about. So knowing Bhagavad Gita gives you the qualification to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. And right in the very beginning, Srimad Bhagavatam states, what's the qualification really for hearing this? Paramahamsa Nirmat Sarana Amsatam. Very often you will find Vedic literatures directly, but if not directly, indirectly, they will state this, what is this Adhikara? What is the qualification for who should be reading this book? Bhagavatam says that actually the persons who are really qualified to read this are Paramahamsas. Well, I mean, that doesn't take much analysis, that one should recognize that one's not a Paramahamsa. So what happens then? One needs to hear Srimad Bhagavatam and study it under the direction of Paramahamsa in order to get a proper understanding. Otherwise, the subject matter can easily get lost. But if one does do that, and one does have access to that, then one becomes qualified to hear that further. And there are so many subject matters of the Bhagavatam. What is the first thing that one should understand? One should understand the process of devotional service. Krishna talks about manmanamavamadbhakto, but he doesn't say so much about what is this bhakti. Srimad Bhagavatam begins by understanding what is devotional service. Srila Prabhupada makes the statement, devotees know, unless you're free from bodily attachment, unless you're free from sex life, you shouldn't go past the second canto. This is a statement of adhikar, of qualification. We do go past the second canto, even despite the fact that we have bodily attachment. However, one should actually be self-controlled, even though one may not be fully free from attachment, still one should be able to control both one's mind and one's senses. And then enter into more elaborate topic, what is being discussed later on in third and fourth cantos, things like creation, things like the nature of the absolute truth, and particularly we start hearing about different incarnations of the Lord. Start off with Lord Varaha. You have to have faith. Your faith has to be nishta if you're going to believe that God is a pig. And if you don't have faith, then you won't be able to progress forward. For us, and we can see what the important thing, I just use that word, we use the word Varaha means boar, but essentially it comes to the same thing, whether he says a boar, or later on he's going to say he's a lion, or that he's a turtle, or he's a fish. Why do we believe these things? Because we have the guidance of Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada's purports. We have the guidance of Paramahansa Nirmatsaranam, and we've developed the type of faith that we accept this very easily. Now you walk into the church next door and you tell them God is a fish who happens to be 8 million miles long and has a golden horn on his head, and see what they do to you where they tell you to go. So that requires faith. And if someone doesn't actually have the full faith for that, if he doesn't have full faith in Krishna's divinity, in the fact that why do these different incarnations appear and why do they manifest these different forms? Why does he look like that? You've all had that experience. Everyone has this experience, I think, that when somehow or another out of some book, someone opens the book and sees a picture of Nrisimhadev, they have serious questions. They want to know what's going on here. Is this God? And then you have one of two things. Either you waffle and beat around the bush trying to say, well, you know, God has this fearsome feature, but he's not always like that. Or you just say, well, yeah, that's God. And in any case, it's extremely difficult because people don't have that adhikar. They just can't jump from the fact where they don't even accept the fact that God's a person. What to speak of the fact that he displays these type of roles and pastimes, and that he gets angry and he has this ferocious feature. We take it for granted because we've been nurtured, and naturally our devotion builds up where we accept things that are just inconceivable to people. People can't, this guy's a turtle and his back is itching and you put a mountain on it, and come on, that's why they call it mythology. And because they don't have the foundation, they don't have the adhikar, they don't have the qualification to understand this thing. And if you don't understand, if you can't understand this thing, then don't go forward and try to understand that he's a human being, because that's even more difficult. Turtle and fish and other things, Raha and lion, all right, but God's a cowherd boy. I mean, these things are supernatural. So, 8 million miles long, that's like something really big. But you mean he looks just like me, and he walks around barefoot taking care of cows? That's like really, really too much. If you can't believe that he can do anything, and that he can assume any form, then it becomes exceedingly difficult to accept him when he's extraordinary. It's more difficult to accept God to be extraordinary than to accept that he's ordinary. Because the whole idea of God is that he's extraordinary. It's okay, let's say he's this extraordinary, manifests this extraordinary feature. He's got four arms. I mean, that's like, oh yeah. And yeah, what about when he has 10 arms? And what about when he's top on top of the mountain, which is on top of the turtle's back, and he's got 1,000 arms? Yeah, right. 1,000 arms. So, but until then, until you can accept that he's got 1,000 arms, you're not going to be able to accept that he's only got 2. Because it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult to think that he behaves just like us. Where was I? I was just over at St. Jaya Prabhu's house with Natasha and the kids talking, and I was just telling them the story about that this Navi Brahman, which is in Jagannath, and that was originally came from the material body that Krishna left behind. That's a very, you have to have a lot of faith to believe that Krishna's body, material body, was cremated. And like all other living beings, unless it's cremated at a very, very high level and do just ordinary with the fire, then there's a certain substance that remains, that doesn't burn. And that is in Jagannath. Is it material? Is it spiritual? And I gave that story because in one of the reasons that they're extremely selective in not selective, that they don't let non-Hindus, so-called non-Hindus, into the temple in Jagannath Puri is because there has been a lot of outrage against Jagannath in the history of the temple. One of the examples was when Muslims took Jagannath all the way to Calcutta, and Howrah, and they threw him onto a funeral pyre and burnt him. And one devotee followed, and he went into the fire. And he took out that Navi Brahman, and he went back and they installed Jagannath. And you can have a lot of, you have to have adhikar to accept the fact that here's a deity, and this deity gets burned, and then he gets established again. It just doesn't, otherwise what do people think? It's idol worship. When you don't have qualification, you think, well, alright, yeah. To see that this is some kind of leela, some kind of pastime, that Jagannath is, you know, giving up this form here and he's taking another form there. Once again, all of these things require a certain qualification. And yeah, nishtha also means faith. So as our faith grows, our ability to invest that faith in higher degrees of knowledge and understanding develops. So ultimately, real faith means the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And that's how Srimad Bhagavatam begins. Aside from the birth of Lord Krishna, the main pastime, beginning pastime that's being described is this Damodar Leela. And the particular feature of that leela that's emphasized is Prakash Maharaj is trying to understand how did this Yashoda Mai, how did she get to the stage of having this type of devotion where the Supreme Personality of Godhead became his son? And she only thought of him as her son. She didn't think of him as the Supreme Lord. Because Prakash Maharaj was understanding, we've talked about so many other things, but it was always very clear, here is God. When Vamandeva appears, it's very clear to everyone that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even to his parents. But here, Mother Yashoda, she just thinks, this is my son. So how did we get from understanding and being impressed by the divinity of the Supreme Lord, and all of a sudden we're coming to the stage where all of this is all, it's all buried, it's all lost. And what's it then lost in? It's then lost in this spontaneous affection for Krishna. How did she get it? Where does it come from? So then he tells the story of Drona and Dhara, which is really the partial explanation. And Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas, they sort of elaborate on that further. So ultimately this is all, and that's why Srila Prabhupada says that Srimad Bhagavatam is a systematic development. What is it a systematic development of? It's a systematic development, a cultivation of faith, where canto by canto by canto, devotees' faith increases, their knowledge develops, their qualification for understanding the next canto matures, until they come actually to the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where then there's Krishna's pastimes. And then you start with Krishna's childhood pastimes, and then it develops like that into other such things. So, and then this becomes the real focus. It's not everyone in India knows what's the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam, Ras Panchadhyay. Those five chapters from 29 to 35, that 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, that deal with the rasa dance, that's the center, that's the focus. And to understand that, you really have to have matured.